My guest is drummer and composer Max Roach. He's one of the inventors of modern jazz drumming. Together with Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, Roach helped formulate the language of bebop. In the mid-50s, Roach teamed up with trumpeter Clifford Brown to form what many jazz fans regarded as the quintessential bop group of the time. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz music inspired by the Civil Rights Movement. Since then, Roach has continued to experiment with new forms. His score for a Sam Shepard play won an Obie Award. Last year, Roach collaborated with Alvin Ailey's dance troupe on Survivors, a tribute to Nelson and Winnie Mandela. Max Roach is also a professor of music at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He has a new album that's called Bright Moments on the Soul Note record label. It features his double quartet, that is, his jazz quartet, along with a string quartet. Before we meet Max Roach, let's listen to a piece from Bright Moments. This is Double Delight. My guest is Max Roach, and we heard a selection from his new album, Bright Moments. Max Roach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
You're really trying something different in this new album. You have your jazz quartet and a string quartet.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, you know, that like Charlie Parker with recorded with strings, but
yes.
It was very pop, dressy, kind of schlocky strings in a way. And you're trying to use strings in a different way for jazz. What's your vision with this?
Well, I'm thinking about strings out front, so to speak. excuse me. It's the string quartet is an integral part of the musical action as well as the soloist. Usually, the rhythm section is the second line, and the front line is the horns, piano, etc. But since we aren't using a piano, I wanted to have the string quartet as prominent a part of the music as the saxophone, trumpet, bass drums, etc. The whole group. Everybody is really the front line, was the conception. So that's why Double Delight, which is a composition by a young trombonist, Steve Turing, who's making quite a name for himself as a performer and as a composer in New York, he caught the essence of the conception. You know, our first LP was Easy Winners. And plus the fact that my my daughter, the idea originated from my mother. My mother said, well, you've made records. My daughter went to, graduated from Oberlin and went to Europe to study with Primrose. She's the violist in the group. And she actually organized the quartet. She found the personnel. She found four very talented young women. We'll talk about it a little later, of course, but... she said to me one day, she said, you know, after my daughter had come back from Europe, she says, you've recorded with Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, and Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis, and Bud Powell, and all these folks. When are you going to do something with Maxine? That's my daughter's name. So I said, you know, Mom, I never thought about it. And that was the germ of the idea. Then years later, of course, I began to say, I want to do something with strings, not as, say, a horn player. And some very good things were done, of course, Bobby Hackett and Clifford Brown, as well as Charlie Parker, but in a different vein. I wanted to as a drummer, to bring the strings right out front, of course, because now I'm not going to play ballads, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes strings are used to dress something up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's not what you're doing with
No, this. I wanted them to work just as hard as, say, the saxophone soloist or the trumpet soloist.
Now, sometimes if you hear a drummer leading a group, you assume that the drummer's always going to be at the forefront. There's going to be seven really loud drum solos throughout. And that's not the case
in your
group either.
No, you... to balance a recording, this should be just balanced. It should be something fast, something medium, something slow, something a little romantic, such as Tyrone Brown's dedication to Duke Ellington, you know, that piece, so forth.
My guest is drummer Max Roach. I'd like to talk about your life a little bit. You got your start, I think, playing in Coney Island for at sideshows. Is that right?
That's true. We used to do sometimes 12, 14 shows a day, and we'd have a barker outside. It was a barker who'd say, come on in, and the girls would go out and shake a little bit, and then the public would come in. We'd do, a 40-minute show and have 20 minutes off, and they'd go back out. Real side show. I enjoyed it.
What kind of music did you play?
Well, we played everything from small group versions of Cacciatorian pieces where we were the fire eaters, ladies would dance and put fire all over themselves, and a comedian would say a few jokes, and a lot of fine musicians, dancers and choreographers had to do that for a living. I did it during the summers, you know, and...
You were a teenager then.
Teenager, and that was it. You know, in order to master, I guess, your instruments, you have to do everything. I played with the local symphony orchestra, played... the Coney Island sideshows and played with marching bands. Just it was, have drums will travel, so to speak, was my credo at that time.
Were you different than the other drummers who were playing in the same kinds of bands you were at the time? Did you know that you were doing something different?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so it's right next door, of course, to Manhattan. And I think we all did the same things. Some of the guys dropped out. Some people, they got married or went to the post office or whatever, but there were some marvelous music. I grew up with some marvelous musicians.
How did you first meet some of the people who you became very close with and made now classic music together with? I'm thinking of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Did they find you? Did you find them?
Well, Dizzy Gillespie heard me at a jam session in a place called Monroe's Uptown House. Clark Monroe was the brother-in-law of Billie Holiday's first husband, Jimmy Monroe, and he was like a kind of a patron for young talent in these after-hour clubs. These after-hour clubs would open up at 4 in the morning and go until 8, so we could work those places and still go to school, Bud Powell and a crowd of us. Well, he heard me. He was with Cab Calloway. He heard me. He says, someday when I get my own band, when I leave Cab Calloway, I would like for you to play for me. That's how I met Dizzy, and Dizzy got introduced me to Coleman Hawkins. I got my first record date. And Dizzy was kind of like the catalyst of that whole movement that we call bebop. You know, he brought Charlie Parker, he discovered, in a way, you know, he brought Charlie Parker to New York and Bud Powell and all these wonderful people. He kind of had a group around him, you know, and I was just fortunate enough to be part of that, but that's how I really got started.
You were one of the first drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. It was a period where instrumental virtuosity was in our area, in the jazz area, was now prevailed. Because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cavalry taxes, very complex. Simply, to put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. And upon that, he had, on top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This just tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. Everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before? And what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to invent new rhythms.
Yeah, well, I had help, too. I had a lot of help. I had my my mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb and Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band, for folks who don't know these. These were people who played with Louis Armstrong and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band contexts. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us, actually. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that first small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. And that's, and we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. Thank you. That was Coco, as recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
sure
much?
It sure does. And the Charlie Parker at that time, as well as Dizzy, the music was very, very fresh. And I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene. And they would say things, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles. And Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales. And Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand. And it was, you know, we were criticized. But some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go, you know.
Well, I want to talk some more about your life and your music, but we're going to take a short break here. My guest is drummer and composer Max Roach. This is Fresh Air. Drummer and composer Max Roach is my guest. And by the way, he has a new recording out called Bright Moments that features him along with his double quartet. You know, the period that you were playing, you were talking about how radical you were, and the musicians were not only radical in their music, but radical in their style as well, and the kind of clothes that many of the musicians wore, berets and everything. And there was a language of the music. And I was wondering if you were ever plagued by hipsters who wanted to, you know, talk hip to the musicians and wanted to hang out with the musicians.
Well, some of the writers were influenced by the music, like Kerouac. He was really into it. So he created a style of writing that had no periods or anything to it. You know, well, I don't know whether he created it or not, but he felt that. And then there was the painter.
Pollock, are you thinking of?
Yeah, Pollock, who also was influenced by it. He had a conception of what improvisation was within this mode that was created by the boppers at that time. And you're right, there were people who came, oopapada and ooh-lua. You know, there were people who would come up to us and talk that language, yeah.
Was this the life you had planned on when you wanted to become a jazz musician? Because you started playing at a time when the big bands were still
correct.
Around. And being a jazz musician meant going on tour with Earl Hines or Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, one of the big bands. But you actually came of age. You know, you grew right after that. Mm-hmm. You came of age in a time when it was small groups, as you were saying before. And the life just became very different.
It did. Well, I hadn't planned on really becoming taking jazz music that seriously at the time. But the war and all the things that did happen. And then while I was in my senior year at Boys High, I said I'd met this gentleman, Clark Munro, and worked in his after hour club. Well, Sonny Greer, Duke's great drummer, was ill, and most of the great drummers were in the Army, like Joe Jones, Sidney Catlett, etc. I could read music. So, Clark, because in those after-hour spots, you played, as I said before, for Shake Dancer, you played Cachaturian, you did all kinds of things. And when Sonny Greer got sick, Duke Ellington called Mr. Munro up did he know a drummer who could play a show? Duke was at the New York Paramount. He said, I got a kid who works my club that plays a show. And I went down to the New York Paramount, make a long story short, got on the stage and looked at Mr. Greer's music stand. There was no music stand and no music. And I couldn't play by ear at that time. You know, I was about 17. So everything was by ear. So Mr. Ellington, before the curtain came up, he looked at me and saw the fright, the fear in my face and said, keep one eye on me and one eye on the act on the stage. And I made it through, but then I made up my mind I wanted to be in this area of the music because Duke had all the theater and the drama and the pageantry was just surrounded him when he presented a show. And that's when I really decided that was what I wanted to do.
In the 1960s, in the early 1960s, you started to play music inspired by the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Had you become an activist then?
Well, I guess we always have been. You know, it was just something that people ask me that quite often, but I go back to Bessie Smith with Black Mountain Blues and then to Duke Ellington with his Black, Brown, and Beige. And it's always been there. Had Leadbelly always spoke about the issues and the times that existed. And many of the old black folk singers from the South, the street musicians, dealt with it. And so to me, it was just I had an opportunity to say something, and I used In fact, the suite was commissioned by the youth movement of the NAACP, and we premiered it here in Philadelphia at one of their conventions. That's what it was. In 1960, we were originally commissioned to do something for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, and so that's how it came about.
Was it at all risky for you to do politically inspired music, or were you going to? Did you run into any trouble in getting recording dates afterwards, or club dates, because of your involvement in the civil rights movement? And you know, I don't think so.
I'll tell you what did happen that was very positive. It sneaked into South Africa, or rather, it went into South Africa. It didn't sneak in. It was taken into South Africa as a jazz musician's album until people read the liner notes put out by Nat Hentoff, and the pieces were a comment. Of course, Oscar Brown Jr., of course, was the lyricist on the work. It was a comment on the things that happened in Sharpeville, the massacre, and things like that. So when the authorities in South Africa realized that this was not just simply a jazz album, they banned it and hit the UPI and AP. And it became a celebrity record, and it sold more records, I guess, than anything I had ever made at that time. So something came out of it because of that, and the musicians from South Africa, like Hugh Masekela and Dollar Brand, they were listening and buying it and taping it and things like that. But it was, it's amazing how things turn around. See, so the Freedom Now Suite, I've always been an activist. I've got. At that time, of course, my children were young, but you're always thinking about, you know, their future as well. And it has to be, if they're going to come up and be responsible human beings, they have to have education and things like everyone else has. And the society has to accommodate that. So I guess I've always been an activist because of that. Mm-hmm.
You were one of the most influential drummers in modern jazz. And, well, some of the people who you played with died tragic deaths from overdoses or car accidents. Just a lot of terrible things had happened to musicians. You're not only a survivor, but you've kept changing. You know, your music has kept progressing. And I wonder if there was ever any temptation to just keep doing what you had become famous for, as many artists do.
Well, you know, Terry, what happened, it's like being at the university. You either publish or perish. In the recording industry, the first thing they ask you is, Max, what do you have new when you want to record? You say, well, I'm going to repeat myself. They say, well, you've already done the things that, of course, we couldn't anyway with Clifford Brown, as great as that music is, or was, or, and still is, or with Charlie Parker. You cannot repeat yourself. Sometimes you miss because you're always trying for other things. I think one of the leading exponents of dealing with that problem is Miles Davis. I mean, I think what he does when he changes is significant, and it works, as far as I'm concerned. But you have to change in the business. You cannot repeat yourself if you are, quote, a supposedly creative artist. And the record companies, of course, are like that. They say, well, maybe jazz went into a commercial decline. I mean, it was put on the back burner for a few years. It seems to be coming back out now. But it could have been because everybody was the same. You know, there wasn't anything. And, of course, the producers and the musicians, they tried all kinds of things. They tried fusion. That means you played jazz this and had some rock or whatever. Some of it worked and some of it worked and some of it did not. And some of the musicians were destroyed from it, some of the great ones. Because the public, if you make a record that is flat-out commercial and in the rock scene, when you go to play something serious, say, like some of the repertoire of Thelonious Monk and some of the players, Herbie Hancock can do it and gets away with it. But he's an exceptionally gifted young musician. But maybe that has something to do with why jazz was on the back burner. But it's coming right out front again, and it looks good.
Well, you're doing very well.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today and talking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been drummer and composer Max Roach. And He has a new album on the Soul Note record label that's called Bright Moments. It features his double quartet. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.